clouds are the least of Ross Gelspan's worries. As a journalist, Gelspan's been reporting on climate change for years, and his conclusions could make you sweat. In 1997, Gelspan wrote The Heat Is On, a book about the coming climate crisis. He told Steve Paulson that today, thanks to global warming, planetary changes are happening faster than anyone could have predicted.
The biggest glacier in the Andes was retreating by about 14 feet a year 20 years ago. Today it's retreating by 99 feet a year. The biggest glacier on the planet, which is the Greenland ice sheet, since 93 has been losing 3 cubic miles of ice each year. That's about enough to cover the state of Maryland with ice a foot thick. This is happening to glaciers all over the world, except, ironically, in the North and South Pole areas, because there, as the temperature warms, you're getting much more snow, so those glaciers are building up. But in between, all the rest of the world's glaciers are retreating very rapidly.
How much does the temperature have to rise for a glacier to melt?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's very striking because for the past 100 years, the temperature has risen only by about 1 degree. And as a consequence of that 1 degree of warming, we're seeing accelerated sea level rise, glacier melt. We're seeing much more violent weather. We're seeing a change in the timing of the seasons. All that has resulted from 1 degree of warming.
Is this 1 degree Celsius or Fahrenheit?
This is 1 degree Fahrenheit. It's about 0.7 degrees Celsius.
That's astonishing that it can have that much of an effect.
That's right. There are 2,000 scientists reporting to the UN. They're part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They're the ones who really produce the studies on climate change and global warming. And they're astounded by how sensitive the planet systems are to even a very small amount of warming. And what's very troubling is these impacts that we've been talking about result, as I say, from about 1 degree Fahrenheit. And by contrast, they are projecting increases of 4 to 10 degrees in this new century. So the outlook is very troubling indeed.
Now, there are a number of stories that are starting to emerge, apparently, as a result of global warming. One is the unearthing of Inuit graves in the Yukon on Herschel Island.
That was a story that was done by a reporter in the Washington Post. And it's basically a consequence of the melting of the permafrost up in that area. And so what's happening is that people whose bodies were buried in the ice are now surfacing again. That particular group of people happens to have a taboo against people touching corpses of dead people. They're afraid that if they do, they will have some kind of a curse on them. So they're leaving these bodies exposed. They're not reburying them. And that's having a rather traumatic cultural impact on those people. But there are other even larger impacts that we're seeing. For instance, rising sea levels are forcing the evacuations of whole populations. There is a small group of islands off of New Guinea called the Duke of York Islands. 40,000 inhabitants are now being relocated because of rising sea levels. Last year, the Prime Minister of New Zealand offered to take in the entire population of 2 other islands in the Pacific. So that also is another indication of how it's beginning very directly to disrupt people's lives.
Now, another thing that we've been hearing about are the increasing violence of storms. And a lot of people say that this seems to be as a result of global warming. What are we seeing there?
What you're basically seeing is many more droughts, more heat waves, more intense storms, not necessarily more frequent, but more intense storms. And also the fact that we're getting much more of our rain and snow in these very severe downpours. So, for instance, I think Houston had 35 inches of rain either last year or earlier this year. There's just a long, long laundry list of these severe floods and extreme droughts that are happening. I think 2 million farmers in Central America this year basically were without crops because of a protracted drought in that area. And there's sort of a financial analog that verifies the increase in these events. The property insurance industry was losing basically something like $2 billion a year in the 1980s to these extreme weather events. That number increased sixfold to $12 billion a year in the 90s. In 1998 alone, the insurance industry lost $89 billion to extreme weather events. And the head of the Reinsurance Association of America said that unless something is done to stabilize the climate, it could very well bankrupt the entire industry.
What kind of impact is global warming having on the Earth's wildlife?
In many cases, it's causing migration of species. And in some cases, this is thought to perhaps lead to extinction of species, or that it will lead to extinction of species. One example I can give you happens to do with a very well-studied area, which is the area of Monterey Bay off the coast of California. And in a 20-year period, scientists documented almost a complete turnaround of the marine population, with cold water fish moving northward and warm water fish and sea animals moving in to populate the area. As the ocean warming is pushing fish northward, whole populations of butterflies have moved from the mountains of Mexico to the hills of Vancouver. And this is just, again, in general keeping with animals trying to maintain some kind of temperature stability and migrating in order to do that.
And you're saying the projections are that the Earth's atmosphere will warm several more degrees if current trends continue. Let's speculate for a moment on what the impact might be. I suppose the obvious one is that sea levels will rise.
Sea levels will rise. The glaciers will continue to melt. The sea level rise is about something like 0.4 of an inch a year right now, which again is more rapidly than sea levels have risen for 10,000 years. About half that sea level rise comes from water from melting glaciers. And the other half of that rise comes from just the thermal expansion of the water. As the water warms, it expands. And the combination of the expanding water and the melting glaciers is rising sea levels, so that we can expect real serious changes in, for example, New Orleans area, the area of Cape Cod, Bangladesh, the Netherlands, all kinds of low-lying areas around the world that are particularly susceptible to sea level rise. One other impact that is gone relatively underestimated, I think, has to do with the spread of infectious diseases. Because of all the systems of nature, one of the most sensitive to temperature changes is insects. And warming accelerates the breeding rates and the biting rates of insects, and it also allows them to live longer at higher altitudes and higher latitudes. So we are now seeing mosquitoes, for instance, spread malaria and yellow fever and dengue fever to populations that have never before experienced them. In my part of the country, in Boston, we've seen a big increase in tick-borne Lyme disease because, except for last winter, we haven't had these deep killing frost winters that kill off the ticks. So I think there's a very direct public health impact here also.
Now, I have the impression that in Europe, at least, global warming is accepted as fact. There's really no disagreement about whether this is happening or not. And that's not the case in the United States. I mean, most scientists say it is happening, but there is still a certain percent. I don't know about scientists, but there are still a number of people in America who doubt the significance of this whole thing.
You know, it's very interesting. I am a journalist, and I've spent 30 years as a journalist, and I did not come to this subject as an environmentalist. I came to the subject because I learned that basically the fossil fuel lobby was conducting a very intense campaign of disinformation almost exclusively inside the United States. And that was designed to keep the public and policymakers thinking that this was all stuck in the limbo of scientific uncertainty.
But the industry does cite scientists. I mean, they're not just inventing the skepticism.
No, they're not. But if you look at the scientists working on this issue, the number who are persuaded that this is happening is overwhelming compared to a very, very small number who don't. In the case of the campaign I was talking about, it turned out that about three or four scientists were being paid money by the fossil fuel lobby. They were not disclosing the receipt of that money, and they were being given large amounts of media space and time. And so the public, the American public, really got the impression that this is an issue which is undecided and to which there are really two sides. But if you really look at all the scientists working on various aspects of climate change, there's virtually no debate among that scientific community of what's really happening. There are debates about second-level impacts and so forth. There's no debate about the larger trends except for a very, very small handful. So, for instance, you have more than 2,000 scientists on this intergovernmental panel. You have maybe about a dozen visible skeptics, many of whom have received funding from the fossil fuel lobby, and that's really what got me as a reporter into this whole subject.
Do you worry about the diversion of interest and awareness on this issue? I mean, given what's been happening in the world ever since September 11th, is global warming now on the back burner?
It's temporarily on the back burner, and I think that's appropriate. I think it's very important that we deal with what's happened on September 11th. On the other hand, this issue is not going to go away. And as you mentioned before, the Europeans in particular, and most of the other countries in the world, are taking the issue very seriously. The U.S. under President Bush withdrew from the climate negotiations. The rest of the world went ahead and completed a Kyoto Protocol. Granted, its initial goals are very low, but the whole idea is to ramp it up so that it can achieve the kind of reductions that are necessary to stabilize the climate. And I have no doubt that that's going to be going forward. I think there is a very, very strong economic engine that will propel this issue forward, and that's this. The science is unambiguous, which is to say, to attain climate stabilization, we must globally reduce our emissions of fossil fuel use by 70%. And that means a rapid global change to new energy sources, to solar energy, wind energy, hydrogen fuel, and so forth. There is a huge market for these new technologies. And already you've seen big splits within the oil industry. British Petroleum is now the world's biggest seller of solar systems. Shell has invested $1 billion in a new core company to make renewable energy. Texaco has been putting large investments into hydrogen-powered fuel cells. So clearly, even people within the industry know this is coming, and they're trying to position their companies to be prominent players in a new energy economy. And I think that is ultimately what will drive this transition.
Ross Gelbspan is the author of The Heat Is On. He spoke with Steve Paulson.